with the idea of peace, cheerfulness, harmony, and contentment. Few families attain the ideal that Adam Smith sketches with such appeal, and I certainly didn't always play my part to contribute to the atmosphere of peace, cheerfulness, harmony, and contentment within my own family. But to strive for it and to work toward it, for me, was an important element of being happier at home. The month of April. Neighborhood. Embrace here. Anything one does every day is important and imposing, and anywhere one lives is interesting and beautiful. Gertrude Stein, Paris, France. Resolutions? Be a tourist without leaving home. Practice non-random acts of kindness. Find my own Calcutta. Create a secret place. For this month, I wanted to concentrate on the sense of home I felt outside my apartment. April, with its warmer weather, was a good month to think about my neighborhood, because I no longer had to rush from door to door to avoid the cold. My more leisurely daily walks heightened my desire to engage with the places and people around me. I've never had much wanderlust, and for a long time I felt apologetic about my lack of passion for traveling. Didn't my love of hanging around my own apartment, instead of exploring the world, show a lack of adventurousness, a limited curiosity about other cultures, a cramped sense of possibility? Not to mention an overdependence on the availability of diet soda. But when I pushed myself to be Gretchen and accept my real likes and dislikes, I faced up to this truth about myself. Partly, it's because I don't have much interest in many things that other people travel to find. I'm a picky eater, so going to new restaurants or trying a foreign cuisine isn't particularly fun. I dislike shopping. I like visiting museums, to a point. I don't speak any other languages. I don't have many friends who live abroad. I don't have a passion such as hiking, art collecting, or bird watching to give me a reason to travel. Every once in a while, I spend a day without stepping foot outside our apartment, and I consider it a great treat. I love a staycation. I wouldn't want to live any place except New York City. Jamie wouldn't either. Not only does he live in the city where he grew up, but he also lives on the same block where he grew up. Every day, New York makes me happy. And when I feel unhappy, I sometimes comfort myself with thoughts of the city around me. Its immensity soothes me. It's like the ocean, or a mountain, or a vast prairie. I call this my under-the-bridge feeling after one of my favorite songs by the Red Hot Chili Peppers about Los Angeles. I love New York's inexhaustible possibilities. All those apartments lined up along long hallways, countless offices, shops, parks, each one the center of its own universe. What waits behind all those doors? And New York City buildings share a strange, magical quality. They're always bigger on the inside than they appear from the outside. At night, if I can't sleep, I walk from room to room in our apartment to look at the sleeping faces of my family. Safe, safe, safe. Then I stand by the window in the dark and gaze across the street to the dark buildings there. I'm always cheered to see a few glowing lights, signs of neighbors nearby. I remember walking down Lexington Avenue on 9/11 in shock, thinking, is all this under threat? Could it be wiped away? I took comfort in the solid, familiar life around me. At the same time, however, I knew that people who travel to new places and try new things are happier than those who stick only to the familiar. New experiences stoke my imagination, too. I get fresh ideas and creative energy from traveling, even if I don't particularly look forward to doing it. Given my responsibilities, I wouldn't have been able to leave home much even if I'd wanted to. And I didn't want to. Instead, this month I'd try to combine the pleasures of being at home and on holiday by making an effort to see the familiar with new eyes. To do more to appreciate my neighborhood, I resolved to be a tourist without leaving home. At the same time, to be a better neighbor, I resolved to practice non-random acts of kindness, as well as to find my own Calcutta. That is, to find a cause to which I felt a singular obligation. And although I didn't know it when the month started, April would include another resolution as well. I also vowed to make an album of the family photographs I'd taken since January. Be a tourist without leaving home. New York City is the place where my dentist has his office and where I buy paper towels, but it's also one of the great cities of the world. People travel across the world to come here, and I've never even visited the Statue of Liberty. It's easy to let the city fade into backdrop, so in April, I wanted to heighten my appreciation for it. Its grandeur, its possibilities, its treasures. After all, research shows that people who remind themselves of the excellence and beauty in their lives have a greater sense of meaning and happiness. And New York City, to me, is more than a collection of monuments. Historian Mircea Eliade describes the privileged places of our lives, which might include a man's birthplace, or the scenes of his first love, or certain places in the first foreign city he visited in youth. Even for the most frankly non-religious man, all these places still retain an exceptional, a unique quality. They are the holy places of his private universe. I had my own private landmarks, my personal historical sites, my favorite corners. To appreciate the public treasures of the city and my private holy places, I resolved to be a tourist without leaving home. Be a tourist didn't mean visiting every tourist spot, Ellis Island, the Cloisters, Radio City Music Hall, the American Girl Store. It meant having the eye and the enthusiasm of a tourist. A tourist reads and studies. A tourist shows up. A tourist sees things with fresh eyes. Without quite realizing it, I'd done this be a tourist exercise the last time I visited New Haven. Because I went to Yale for both college and law school, returning there always evokes powerful emotions. In particular, because Jamie and I met in law school, I have many happy memories of our relationship's early days. The last time I was back, I decided to return to some important sites in our falling in love history. I visited our carrels in the law library, the stone staircase where we stood talking, the copper kitchen diner where we once met for breakfast, the wooden bench where we held hands for the first time. I took photos of every site. Everything changes, and the copper kitchen is already gone. And one day the wooden bench and even the stone staircase will be gone. But I have my record. Gertrude Stein remarked, "Anything one does every day is important and imposing, and anywhere one lives is interesting and beautiful." New York City, my city, is interesting and beautiful to me simply because I live here. I made a list of how to be a tourist without leaving home. Call up past memories. As I traveled the streets each day, I made an effort to recall important memories. There's the Gymboree where Jamie and I stopped to buy red tights for Eliza as we walked to the hospital when I was in labor with Eleanor. There's the corner of 69th and 3rd Avenue where I said to Jamie, "Really? You could write an admiring biography of Churchill or a damning biography of Churchill, and they'd both be true." And Jamie answered, "You could write a biography like that," and inspired me to write 40 Ways to Look at Winston Churchill. There's the building where my father-in-law works. There's the cottage, the Chinese restaurant where my sister and I ate when I visited her when she was in college. There's the green market where my brother and sister-in-law did a demonstration from their cookbook, The Comfort of Apples. Every year, more places take on more meaning. See things with fresh eyes. As I walked down the street, I tried to see the city as a tourist, reporter, or researcher would see it. And I noticed stores just a few blocks from my building that I'd never seen before. I paid more attention to the rhythms of my New York, the daily procession of families walking up the long sidewalks to school, the people stopping at corner fruit stands before heading down to the subway. Watching Woody Allen's New York City movies, Annie Hall, Hannah and Her Sisters, Husbands and Wives, Manhattan, made me see the city anew. Notice the scents. Since I'd adopted February's resolution to embrace good smells, I'd started to do a better job of noticing New York smells. In the past, unless confronted with a powerful stench, such as the stink of a passing garbage truck, I hardly noticed the smells I encountered on every walk. Now I paid close attention to the hot, dusty scent of pavement when it begins to rain, the smell of fresh wood and turpentine in front of a building site, or the particular subway smell. I was puzzled by some olfactory mysteries. Why did this residential side street always smell like movie popcorn? And why did Third Avenue suddenly smell like an October bonfire? What ingredients combine to give all chain drugstores that inevitable odor? Learn more. One thing that I admire about my father is his encyclopedic knowledge of Kansas City. Whenever I ask about the history of a particular neighborhood or about a building under construction, he always knows the answer. I wanted to learn more about New York. Whenever I visited a foreign city, I read a guidebook, and so I read guidebooks for New York City, such as 10 Architectural Walks in Manhattan and Manhattan's Outdoor Sculpture. I'd visited the giant bronze Alice in Wonderland statue in Central Park dozens of times, and learning that Alice was said to resemble the sculptor's daughter helped me appreciate it more. I spent more time reading the Metropolitan section of the New York Times and the Greater New York section of the Wall Street Journal. We'd owned a copy of Kenneth Jackson's enormous Encyclopedia of New York City for years. I moved it from a high shelf to the coffee table and browsed whenever I had a minute. Go off the path. The weekly adventures with Eliza had given me the chance to visit new places right in my neighborhood. I'd lived less than 10 blocks from the Asia Society for more than 10 years, and I'd never walked through its doors until Eliza and I made a Wednesday visit. Along the same lines, when I was driving the car instead of riding in the car, streets that I'd traveled many times before looked new. Spend time on the New Yorker magazine meditation. Ever since I was very young, looking at the covers of the New Yorker magazine has filled me with a strong emotion. Neither happy nor sad, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but a feeling of sharp yearning for New York City. And not the New York that is my New York, but rather the New York that I rarely inhabit. The city of Yankees games, Shakespeare in the Park, rides on the Staten Island Ferry, walks through Williamsburg, commutes to Connecticut. To embrace this New Yorker feeling, I indulged in a modest splurge and bought a used copy of the enthralling The Complete Book of Covers from the New Yorker, 1925 to 1989. Eliza, Eleanor, and I pored over its pages for hours. These pictures invoked the real and unreal New York City of my imagination. Being a tourist is a state of mind. Practice non-random acts of kindness. Of all the elements that make up a neighborhood, the most important are the neighbors. And I wanted to act with greater neighborliness, to work harder to add to the happiness of the people I encountered in my day, in my building, or during my usual routine. This led me to two questions. Did my presence make people happier? And did my actions contribute to conditions that tended to increase other people's happiness? As I considered these questions, it occurred to me that I'd often heard the suggestion that a good way to spread happiness was to practice random acts of kindness. But I disagree. Yes, if I commit a random act of kindness, I will feel happier. Say if I pay the toll for the car behind me or put coins in a stranger's parking meter. That's the second splendid truth, part A, otherwise summarized as do good, feel good. However, research suggests that many people react to receiving a random act of kindness with suspicion. That's certainly true of me. If someone does something randomly kind for me, I'm on my guard. I don't think that my reaction shows cynicism or a deep distrust of mankind. It's not the kindness of the act that's the problem. It's the randomness. If a stranger hands me a dollar bill, I suspect he's trying to invoke the strong psychological phenomenon of reciprocation. When someone gives you something or does something for you, you feel you should reciprocate. Reciprocation is why members of the Hare Krishna Society gave flowers to passers-by in airports, and why charities send complimentary address labels when they ask for money. Also, a random act of kindness might not be well-placed. I might pay the toll for a millionaire, or fill the expired meter for someone who is standing beside me on the sidewalk, ready to drive away in her car. A friend told me that he'd once been stopped on the street by a large man who announced, "I'm giving away free hugs," and hugged him. This hug, though free and a quite random act of kindness, was not appreciated. It's nice to be nice, of course. It's not bad to practice random acts of kindness, but to build my happiness based on the happiness I bring to other people, the noblest ways of boosting happiness, I wanted to perform more non-random acts of kindness. After all, seeing that a stranger, friend, or colleague was acting out of concern for me was cheering. Wondering why someone inexplicably did something unexpected for me, however nice, was a bit unnerving. A friend told me about her wonderful non-random act of kindness. On April 15th, a few years ago, she walked into a post office crowded with people who needed to mail their tax returns and took her place in a huge line for the only stamp dispensing machine. When my friend's turn finally came, instead of buying the minimum number of stamps, she bought a whole sheet of stamps. Then she went along the line of people behind her, handing stamps to each person until she ran out. The people who got the free stamps were thrilled, and even the people who didn't get free stamps were happy because the long, slow line got so much shorter so quickly. Everyone, she said, was surprised, excited, and laughing. It made me so happy to think about this moment. My friend transformed a miserable, tax-paying visit to the post office into a moment of happiness. Not just for herself, but for the strangers in line with her. And for me, too. Perhaps part of the attraction of random acts of kindness is that randomness helps obscure your association with a kind act. Some people believe that getting credit for a good deed somehow minimizes its worth. And along the same lines, some people argue that no altruistic act can be truly selfless because performing a good act itself brings the exquisite pleasure of doing good. My view? Yes, it does, and all the better. One of the best ways to make myself happy is to make other people happy. Again, the second splendid truth, part A, and surely this is one of the most beneficent aspects of human nature. As Montaigne observed, these testimonies of a good conscience are pleasant, and such a natural pleasure is very beneficial to us. It is the only payment that can never fail. I tried to identify ways to do more non-random acts of kindness and to make people happier in my presence on a very small scale. First of all, I aim to do a better job with simple politeness, the lowest level of kindness, but nevertheless important. All too often, I rushed around, so preoccupied with my own thoughts that I didn't even see the tourists peering at a map or the mother struggling with a stroller, so I made more effort to notice when other people needed a hand. Although I don't litter myself, it never occurred to me to do anything about other people's litter. One afternoon, though, I was in the subway where an empty plastic water bottle was rolling around to the great annoyance of everyone in the car. The bottle rolled back and forth, and I thought, someone should pick that up. Then I thought, someone like me, why shouldn't I be the one to pick it up? So I did. My daily swing through the neighborhood brought me into brief contact with a wide number of people, many of whom I saw week after week, but instead of acknowledging this history, my habit was to behave as though I was visiting this drugstore or newsstand for the first time. As a non-random act of kindness, I made the effort to smile and say hello to familiar strangers. These steps seemed so paltry. Nevertheless, I had to admit to myself they meant a real change in my behavior. But I wanted to ask more of myself. I have a very reserved nature, and it would be prohibitively challenging for me to perform acts of kindness that required much interaction with strangers, such as handing out those stamps. I wish I were more open and outgoing, but I'm not. What could I do within the confines of my own nature? I decided to make a much bigger effort to bring people together, such as inviting newcomers to join my various reading and writing groups, and in particular, to recommend people for work. In such a tough economic environment, people needed all the help they could get. During the course of my day, I came into contact with many people who ran their own businesses. Video makers, web designers, writers and editors, virtual assistants, graphic designers, trainers at my gym, artists, literary agents, and social media consultants. I'd always made recommendations, but now I looked for more opportunities to suggest the work of people I respected, and if appropriate, immediately to send a follow-up email with contact information. For instance, whenever I could, I touted the work of Manhattan Home Network's Charles Stanton, the computer specialist to whom I am eternally grateful for his unfailing ability to resolve the IT difficulties to which a self-employed, tech-impaired knowledge worker like myself falls prey. Along the same lines, because I feel a special sympathy for writers, I used my work online to shine a spotlight on great writing. I linked to someone else's blog every day from my blog, and I recommended outstanding books as often as I could. These weren't major acts of kindness. They were the minor, non-random equivalent of paying a stranger's toll or putting money in a parking meter. Nevertheless, even minor acts of kindness are worthwhile. Find my own Calcutta. To cultivate a true sense of neighborliness, I recognized, I must extend my attention beyond the environs of my building and my own circle of acquaintances. But how? A few years ago, when I set out to imitate a spiritual master, I identified my spiritual master as Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, a perhaps curious choice, given that I'm not Catholic. My fascination with Saint Thérèse was so deep that I'd even developed an interest in the other spiritual masters in the Thérèse chain. 16th century Teresa of Avila, the great reformer, founder, and mystic, and the contemporary Mother Teresa, who worked tirelessly with the poorest of the poor in Calcutta and elsewhere. As Mother Teresa was careful to point out, she took her name from Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, the little flower, not from the commanding Teresa of Avila. As I read about Mother Teresa, I was particularly struck by a single phrase. When anyone begged to join her work or asked how to imitate the example of her life, she'd admonished, "Find your own Calcutta." Meaning, instead of grabbing onto the mission that she'd made famous, people should find their own causes. Just as she'd experienced a call within a call that guided her to a particular kind of work, others should discover what cause moved them to action and where their skills could be useful. Had I found my own Calcutta? No. I did volunteer my time, energy, and money to the New York Public Library. I've always been drawn to libraries. I love the sense of possibility and industry, the quiet company, and all those books. In college, for instance, whenever I was feeling blue, I'd go up in the stacks of the enormous Sterling Library. I'd pick a floor at random and explore among the crowded, mysterious shelves. That always gave me a feeling of excitement and adventure, of being on the brink of discovering some treasure. Because I love libraries so much, I was thrilled to have the opportunity to help to keep libraries strong. Volunteering to help others is the right thing to do, and it also boosts personal happiness. A review of research by the Corporation for National and Community Service shows that those who aid the causes they value tend to be happier and in better health. They show fewer signs of physical and mental aging. And it's not just that helpful people also tend to be healthier and happier. Helping others causes happiness. Be selfless, if only for selfish reasons, as one of my happiness paradoxes holds. About 1/4 of Americans volunteer, and of those, 1/3 volunteer for more than 100 hours each year. Also, although the subject of self-esteem has generated a fair amount of controversy over the past few decades, it's clear that we don't get healthy self-esteem from constantly telling ourselves how great we are, or even from other people telling us how great we are. We get healthy self-esteem from behaving in ways that we find worthy of our own respect, such as helping other people. But while it's true that helping other people makes us happier, and that people feel a distinct helper's high, it's also true that when people are unhappy, they often find it tough to help others. If they did, they'd likely feel happier. But unhappy people often feel preoccupied with their own problems and don't have the emotional reserves to turn outward. By contrast, happy people volunteer more, give away more money, and naturally take an interest in others. I'd observed this in myself. As I'd hoped when I started my first happiness project, as my life became happier, I became more eager to find ways to help other people. But was the New York Public Library my Calcutta? No. To me, Mother Teresa's admonition to find my own Calcutta directed me to find a cause that demanded my particular attention and abilities. But what? I recalled Mencius's observation. The path of duty lies in what is near, and man seeks for it in what is remote. Right nearby, already in my life, was a cause that moved me with particular force. Organ donation. Jamie's hepatitis C meant that his liver was under constant surreptitious attack. We hoped that his liver would last until new treatments emerged, but it might not. So although Jamie is outwardly perfectly healthy and doesn't need a liver transplant now, and may never need one, it was certainly a far more foreseeable situation to us than to most people, and I developed a deep interest in the issue of organ donation. A few years ago, in fact, I'd become involved with the New York Organ Donor Network, now called Live on New York, the OPO, or Organ Procurement Organization, that manages the clinical process of organ donation, coordinates donor matches, and helps donor families here in New York City. My time with this organization had taught me a great deal about the challenges of organ donation. The United States has a huge unmet need for organs for transplant, and Live on New York tried in manifold ways to address this issue. One solution? Get more people to sign up as organ donors. What better non-random act of kindness? 83% of New Yorkers support organ donation in theory. But how to prod them to put their convictions in writing? This step was important. When families confront the issue of whether to donate a person's organs, it's very helpful for them to know what that person wanted. In New York, 95% of those who sign up as organ donors take that step at the Department of Motor Vehicles when they obtain or renew a driver's license or identity card. People can also register online. However, of the New Yorkers eligible, only 15% have signed up. The national average is 40%, and some states have rates as high as 75%. Why? Among other things, New York has an 8-year renewal cycle for a driver's license, good for drivers, but bad for organ donation, and a historically uncooperative DMV. And to make matters worse, for a variety of reasons, the current online registry is cumbersome and confusing. But just at the time that I began to look for my Calcutta, several promising changes occurred. Live on New York had hired a new vice president of marketing and communications. The DMV began to seem more receptive to collaboration, and significantly, a proposal arose to move administration of the registry from New York's Department of Health to the New York Alliance for Donation, a group made up of New York's OPOs and tissue banks. This change would be hugely helpful, because in different hands, the registry could be designed and promoted much more effectively. A few years ago, a friend who works with an organization that funds social entrepreneurs mentioned to me, "Whenever I talk to applicants, I ask them to describe their moment of obligation. I'm always interested to hear the answer." "What's a moment of obligation?" I asked. I'd never heard that term. "It's the moment when you think, hey, someone should really try to improve the distribution of malaria nets, or teach kids about the theater, or whatever, and you realize, hey, I'm the one who should do something. Me." When I thought about the new opportunities for the registry, I felt that moment of obligation. This was my Calcutta. This was one area where I, though no doctor or donor expert, could contribute useful knowledge and work, and I had a fervent belief in the importance of the undertaking. But I hesitated to throw myself into it. I was no expert in online marketing, state health policy, or organ donation? Did I know enough to make suggestions? Shouldn't people with more expertise drive the process? I already felt overtaxed by my own work. Did I have the time and energy to devote to the issue? I so rarely drew on my legal background anymore. Was it appropriate for me to make a suggestion about statutory interpretation? Well, I thought, true, I was no online marketing expert, but I used tools such as Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and MailChimp myself. I didn't know much about web design, but I knew something. I'd trained as a lawyer. I understood the basic issues related to the registry and why change was so urgently needed. As I pressed ahead, I fought my dangerous, familiar desire to keep it simple by limiting my involvement to tasks within my comfort zone. When I'd started, I'd imagined that I'd contribute by explaining how to set up a sign-up box in MailChimp. The task grew far larger than that. Bigger. As I worked to find my own Calcutta, something happened that I hadn't expected. My interest in the registry sparked Jamie's interests, and he also became involved. As events unfolded, his engagement proved invaluable, because he has an encyclopedic memory for the people he has met, what interests them, what knowledge they possess, and what skills they might bring to bear. While I'd been thinking about what I might be able to do, Jamie thought bigger, and he identified several outside people with critical special capabilities. Things began to move much faster once these experts became involved. On a personal level, it was fun to get the chance to collaborate with Jamie. In the first years of our marriage, we'd both ended up working for FCC Chairman Reed Hunt in Washington, D.C., and we often sat in the same meetings and were CC'd on the same emails. I'd loved getting the chance to get an entirely new perspective on Jamie, such as his quirky work email writing style, very different from the personal emails he sends to me. Now we were working together again, in a context that didn't involve our children, vacation travel arrangements, or home repair. What's more, as Jamie and I got more involved, my mother and father-in-law also got more involved, and they each made key contributions of their own. They cared a lot about organ donation, too, but they'd never known a way to help. As so often happens, the more we learned, the more ignorant I felt. The scope of the undertaking seemed to grow and grow as people urged, launch a campaign too, and do a survey to find out whether, and you should call. Also, as more people and more organizations joined the effort, that expansion meant more emails, more meetings, more questions. But did it make me happier to know that I'd done what I could with whatever capacities I possessed to promote the cause of organ donation? Absolutely. One early evening, I ran into my father-in-law on the corner of our street. New York City is a big place, but sometimes it feels as small as North Platte. "Hey," I called out as I saw him climbing stiffly out of a taxi with the two bulging black folders that he carries everywhere with him. "Where are the girls?" "They're with Jamie. Listen, thanks for making that call," I said. He'd recently made an important phone call about the donor registry. "Perfect timing. It really made a difference." "I was glad to," he said. "I get the sense that there might really be some movement. Let me know when there's something else I can do." "I will," I answered. Just as I enjoyed getting the chance to work with Jamie, it was fun to work with my in-laws in this way too, and to have a common interest beyond our personal family concerns. I would never have predicted that this resolution would give me a chance to collaborate with my in-laws. Create a secret place. Before I'd started my happiness project in September, I'd painstakingly mapped out my resolutions for the year. This month, however, I added a resolution right on the spot, near the end of the month, when I finally managed to put into words an inchoate yearning I'd long felt about my home. One overcast April afternoon, I picked up Eliza from school, and we headed to the Whitney Museum for our weekly adventure. As we were leaving the museum, we stopped to admire a piece that I've always loved, Charles Simmons' Dwellings. Tucked into an inconspicuous corner of the main stairwell, by a window, stands a tiny, clay-built landscape of a structure on a mountain, a scene evocative of the cliff dwellings of the American Southwest. It looks ancient. It's small, yet monumental. Eliza and I were studying it when I noticed, somehow for the first time, a descriptive placard that explained that the sculpture in front of us was actually just one part of a three-part sculpture of clay, sand, stones, and wood. The other two parts of the piece stood outside the museum, one installed on a second-story windowsill of the store across the street, and the other lodged under an apartment building's chimney protector. "Oh, wow," I said to Eliza, "read this sign. The other two parts of this sculpture are outside the museum, across the street. What? No way." We both peered out the window. "There it is. I see it," I said, pointing. "I see both of them." "Where?" "There, on the windowsill of that building, and up above, under the little roof over that chimney." "Wow," Eliza breathed. "I see them too. They're outside. Can they do that? Put a piece of art on the outside?" "This is so beautiful," I said, "and we've walked by that building dozens of times. I can't believe we never knew about this." We looked for a long time. "Can we stop a minute?" Eliza asked when we finally walked out of the museum to see the view from the street. "I want to take a picture." "Sure." She held up her phone and took photos from several angles. "You can't really get a good sense of it from the photos," she muttered. On the walk home, we couldn't stop talking about this piece. I hadn't felt so thrilled by an artwork since I saw the Joseph Cornell exhibit at the Chicago Art Institute. For my whole life, I'd wished I could take more pleasure in art. I'd always felt that I was on the brink of appreciating and loving it more, but somehow couldn't find the right passage through which my interests could flow. I took a drawing class, for instance, because I thought that learning to draw might help. But it didn't. When I saw a piece of art that I loved, I felt a tremendous desire to use it, to transform it myself, to incorporate it into myself. And because I had no way to do this, I ended up feeling somehow thwarted. As we were walking home, I asked myself, why do I love dwelling so much? Why do I feel such a fierce attraction to it? One key lesson I've learned from my happiness project is to pay close attention to any flame of enthusiasm. In the past, I'd often ignored a surge of interest. I'd admire some object or be fascinated by some topic, but I wouldn't think much about it. I've come to realize, however, that I don't have so many passions or enthusiasms that I can afford to ignore any of them. I kept thinking about the miniature hidden landscapes of dwellings, and suddenly I had my idea and made my last-minute resolution to create a secret place. "Wait, listen to this," I grabbed Eliza's arm. "I have the greatest idea. Let's put a miniature landscape somewhere in our apartment. Let's make a tiny scene, hidden inside the medicine cabinet or on the top of a bookshelf. That would be amazing. I could envision it perfectly. We'd open up the kitchen cabinet to reveal not a set of dinner plates, but a tiny mountaintop." "Yes, that would be great." Eliza immediately understood exactly what I had in mind. "But the thing is," she added, "it would have to be really good. We can't make anything that good." "Right," I nodded. "We want it to be really beautiful. But how will we find something? I have no idea." "Maybe Charles Simmons has more pieces." "Yes, but his work goes in museums. It would be too expensive. Maybe there are artists, not even professional artists, who make miniature scenes. But how do you find them? It's not like they're listed somewhere. I'll have to do some research." "Can I look too?" "Of course." That evening, when my mother called, I told her about the Simmons piece and about our determination to put a miniature scene in the apartment. "I'm looking at dwellings online now," she said. "It's beautiful. Imagine what it would be like to open up the kitchen cabinet and see a cliff dwelling, or to have a secret mermaid scene in the medicine cabinet. Like Narnia inside the wardrobe," Eliza called out. As I was talking, Eleanor drifted over with a worried face. "Mommy, we have a problem." She looked grave. "Just a minute, Mom. What is it, Enno?" You're telling Bunny that you want a miniature scene, but you know how much I love to play with cunning little things. If you get that, I'll want to play with it in my area. Well, that's true, I told her. I'm glad you raised that issue. We'll have to think about it. She was right. She would want to play with it. We'd deal with that later. Over the next several days, I did research. I asked for recommendations on Twitter and Facebook. Eliza and I did a search on Etsy.com, a site that sells handmade pieces, and I sent a few emails to art-loving friends. I made a note to rent the movie Tiny Furniture. Look at this, I said to Eliza as we searched online on separate laptops. It's called tilt-shift photography. Is it a way to photograph miniatures? She asked, looking over my shoulder. No, I answered. That's what's so interesting. These are photographs of real scenes. The tilt-shift technique makes everything look like a miniature. Could we do that? Maybe. We'll learn more about that when we figured out miniatures. In the end, I found a person, right here in New York City, who did the kind of work I envisioned. I'd put a message on Twitter, I'm looking for artists, and I use that term broadly, who do beautiful work in miniatures. Suggestions? An acquaintance sent me a link to Jacqueline Schmidt's work, and I was immediately enthralled. I emailed her, then spoke to her on the phone. She seemed to understand exactly what I envisioned. When she came over to look at the space, we talked about possible elements. A view of a mountaintop with bluebirds, my personal symbol, daisies, Eliza's symbol, butterflies, Eleanor's symbol, and blackberry bushes, Jamie's symbol, with a brook or pond, bright clouds, a half-hidden treehouse, a nest with four eggs, a fantastical Maxfield Parrish-ish mountaintop, not a realistic mountaintop. After some further conversation, she agreed to get started. I was thrilled. Soon we'd have a miniature scene hidden inside our kitchen cabinet. How much is all this going to cost? Jamie asked that night as I was enthusiastically describing these plans. Remember when we said we should buy something special to celebrate our 40th birthdays? I responded. We never got anything. This is what we should get. Okay, sounds good, he said. But what about losing that prime cabinet space? Where's all our stuff going to go? I'll rearrange everything. It'll be fine. Then I tried to put the miniature scene out of my mind because I knew it would be a long wait before it would be installed in her kitchen. After I'd realized that I love miniatures, I saw that I'd loved them my whole life. For decades, I'd prized a tattered museum booklet about Colleen Moore's Fairy Castle, the exquisite miniature house exhibited at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry. As a child, and even more as an adult, I'd loved the striking picture books of Dare Wright, The Lonely Doll, Take Me Home, The Little One. I'd cut out a Wired magazine piece about Laurie Nix, an artist who builds and photographs miniature scenes. When we'd visited Disneyland last summer, my favorite ride had been Storybook Land with its miniature fairy tale settings. I'd bought, and in September abandoned, that mountain scene to build with Eliza. When I identified the pattern in many things that caught my eye, miniatures, I was able to embrace and build on a passion that I'd somehow never even noticed before, a love of dollhouses, birdhouses, bonsai, model villages, aquariums and terrariums, maquettes, the boxes of Joseph Cornell. If I'd been paying attention, I might have perceived it long ago. But while I love miniatures, an even deeper yearning, something fantastical, almost mystical, was satisfied by my vision of a mountaintop hidden inside a kitchen cabinet. I wanted to create a secret place. Without understanding what I was doing, exactly, I'd already created one secret place in our apartment. Several years ago, after a minor renovation created an odd, awkward area, I decided, for no apparent reason, to hide that space behind a panel that swung open only if pressed in the right spot. Once it was built, in what felt like an ancient impulse, I put one of my favorite framed photographs of my family on the inside shelf. I would rarely see it there, but all the better. It would be the more powerful, hidden. I'd loved the secret place, but I'd never thought much about it, why I'd wanted it, or why it gave me so much satisfaction. It was only after reading Christopher Alexander's A Pattern Language that I recognized my desire for a secret place as a universal instinct. In Alexander's scheme, pattern number 203, child caves, is followed by number 204, secret place. Where can the need for concealment be expressed? The need to hide, the need for something precious to be lost and then revealed. To address this need, A Pattern Language advises, make a place in the house, perhaps only a few feet square, which is kept locked and secret, a place which is virtually impossible to discover until you have been shown where it is. Which is exactly what I'd done. Why? In The Poetics of Space, Gaston Bachelard explains, there will always be more things in a closed than in an open box. To verify images kills them, and it is always more enriching to imagine than to experience. Some of Joseph Cornell's boxes include a drawer permanently shut with a feather or jack inside. This secret treasure has always struck me as extraordinarily significant. With my hidden cabinet mountaintop, we would have another secret place. The four walls of my apartment could contain the vast natural world. Only my family would know it was there. I'd been thinking about this secret place for weeks before I noticed the name of the Simmons piece that had launched me in this direction. Dwellings. The theme of home had again asserted itself in a way that seemed almost too symbolical to be believable. Sheesh. Wholly apart from the quiet pleasures of gaining a deeper appreciation of art and the fulfillment of a lifelong mystical yearning, my quest perfectly illustrated one of my secrets of adulthood. I do best what comes naturally. When I pursue a goal that's right for me, my progress comes quickly and easily. When I pursue a goal that's wrong for me, my progress feels blocked. Now I try not to fight that sense of paralysis, but rather see it as a helpful clue to self-knowledge. I'd first noticed the secret of adulthood in other people. How did you figure out how to animate your slideshow presentation? I'd asked with envy. How did you find a place that serves rum, raisin, rice pudding? Such accomplishments seemed utterly baffling to me. Oh, I don't know, people would answer vaguely. I just asked around. It wasn't that hard. It sure seemed hard. But when people asked me, how did you figure out how to get an agent and start a career as a writer? Or how did you manage to drive traffic to your blog? I heard myself answer the same way. Well, I just did some research. It wasn't that hard to figure out. When I started blogging, I enjoyed building my skills. In September, I'd found it easy to arrange the wisteria painting for my shrine to work. I used to tell myself, I should learn more about art. It's beautiful, it's interesting, it's fun. But I somehow couldn't figure out how to approach it. When I paid close attention to what caught my eye, to what I looked at with pleasure, not what I thought I should like, but what I actually did like, I found my obsession and the way to pursue it. I had so many claims on my time, yet I found myself spending hours looking at the work of certain artists. I didn't have to resolve to suffer for 15 minutes or find other ways to motivate myself to achieve this goal. I couldn't get enough. Christopher Alexander remarked, "It is hard, so terribly hard, to please yourself. Far from being the easy thing that it sounds like, it is almost the hardest thing in the world, because we are not always comfortable with that true self that lies deep within us." B. Gretchen. The last days of April were chilly but gorgeous. We hadn't had any heavy rains, so the pansies and tulips in the flower beds still kept their petals, and the magnolia trees looked magnificent. It was a beautiful time to be a tourist in New York City. Since February, my interest in the sense of smell had exploded, and I'd recently read about a perfume maker, Christopher Brocious, who was known for creating reality-based scents that capture certain experiences and images. Brocious had founded Demeter Fragrance, which I loved, and now had a perfume line called CB I Hate Perfume. Intrigued, I'd ordered samples of his Burning Leaves and To See a Flower, which I found entrancing. And when I learned that Brocious had a perfume gallery in Williamsburg, I vowed to visit it in person, an outing that would allow me to practice my driving embrace good smells, and be a tourist, all in a single morning. Fortunately, I have a close friend who shares my fascination with good smells, loves a good New York City adventure, and, more important, in case I suffered a nervous collapse, knows how to drive. It took us a few weeks to make the trip. First I had to reschedule, then she sent me an email. Turns out I have to be somewhere that morning. Can we go at 2:30? First, I answered, sure. Then I sent her a second email. Only to you can I reveal the depths of my lameness. I'm so skittish about driving. Can we go another day, in the morning? I'm worried about rush hour traffic. Of course, she replied immediately. I couldn't wait to visit the shop, but I dreaded the thought of the drive to Brooklyn. What if we got lost? What if passersby laughed at me while I was trying to parallel park? What if I became overwhelmed with anxiety? The night before, I had a long nightmare about driving. But the trip was wonderful. My friend was imperturbable, reassuring, and gave great directions from the sheets I'd printed out from MapQuest because I still hadn't quite mastered GPS. I found a parking spot right away. We arrived before the store opened, so we sat in a hip Williamsburg coffee shop and talked for an hour. And the shop! The small store had shelf after shelf of shining, tempting bottles. We sniffed from each of the dozens of samples many times. She discovered On the Beach 1966, Hay and Black March. I discovered A Memory of Kindness, T. Rose, and Mr. Hulot's Holiday. The salty breath of the breeze off the Mediterranean, driftwood, rocks covered with seaweed, and the smell of old leather suitcases. She bought some gifts. I bought three additions to my shrine to scent. I love New York, she sighed as we crossed back into Manhattan over the Williamsburg Bridge. So much to see, so many places to go. I know, I said. I know. It's all right here. We're so lucky. Here. Smell. I stretched out my arm in front of her. Hey, she asked. I love it. Love, love, love it, I responded. Here, smell, she said, and held out her arm. On the Beach, 1966? I love that one. The next day, when someone asked me, isn't it a lot of effort to follow all your resolutions? I thought back on that visit. The anxiety, the triumph, the beautiful scents, the adventure with a friend. Sometimes, I said, but the thing is, I'm happier when I do. The day after we made that trip, on the phone with my father, I mentioned that I'd been doing some work on organ donation. My father has a famously enthusiastic nature, but CBI hate perfume would be a stretch for him. You're pretty busy these days, he observed. Yes, I answered. I'm a little too busy, and really, I don't know all that much about it. But this is just something I want to do. That's the best way, just to do what you want to do. Young lawyers come to my office and they ask, what should I get involved in? They're trying to be strategic. They'd like to build the kind of practice I have. My father, who's involved in innumerable business, political, and civic activities, is the kind of lawyer who makes a career in law seem fun. I tell them, don't do what you think you should do. Get involved because something interests you. If you aren't interested, you won't do a good job. You won't stick to it. I got involved in politics because I wanted to, not because I thought it was the smart thing to do. So if you're interested in organ donation, it's great to be involved in some way. There it was again. B. Gretchen. The month of May. Now. Remember now. Safe, 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 the pulse of the house beats wildly. Waking, I cry, oh, is this your buried treasure? The light in the heart. Virginia Woolf, A Haunted House. Resolution? Now is now. Kindergarten was almost over. Sixth grade was almost over. My calendar was full of end-of-year entries. Kindergarten farewell party, bring OJ, buy teacher gift card, sixth grade picnic, arch day, and my least favorite, Camp Health Forms Due. Where had the time gone? I remembered those first bright days in September when Eleanor and I had explored her kindergarten classroom for the first time. In those early days of autumn, Eliza had still walked to school with us. No longer. It was hard to believe that summer had almost arrived. On the first warm weekend morning, I told Jamie, I really want to take the girls to the Central Park Carousel this weekend. Eliza's been there just once in her whole life, and Eleanor has never gone. Fine, Jamie said, but what's the rush? We've got to do these things now. It seems like we have forever to go to the carousel. But Eliza is 12 years old. She's practically too old for a carousel. Maybe she already is. And Eleanor is 6. We should go now. Okay, he said. We'll go today. But in the end, we didn't go. And we still need to make that visit to the carousel. I looked at the fresh, clean May page of my resolutions chart. If only I could keep my resolutions perfectly this month, the last month of my happiness project. Before long, the iron routine of school would lift for a few months, but I didn't want to relax my vigilance about my resolutions. On any particular day, I sometimes wished I could forget about my resolutions. I wanted to work, not visit the Museum of the City of New York with Eliza. I didn't want to take the time to hold open the door for the slow-walking woman or even to say a polite hello to other parents at morning drop-off. I didn't want to dig deep or respond to the spirit of a gift or suffer for 15 minutes. But my life is happier when I keep my resolutions. One evening, as soon as I walked in the door, I gave a preoccupied wave to Ashley, our sitter, and Eleanor as I hurried to scribble a note to myself. If I don't write down important things the minute they occur to me, I never think of them again. As I was writing this crucial note with a broken blue crayon on the back of a school strep throat notification, Eleanor marched over to me with a scowl. "You didn't give me a warm greeting," she said bitterly. "When I said hi, you just said hi and didn't pay any attention to me." "Oh, sweetie," I said, kneeling down, "I'm sorry. I wanted to write myself a note before I forgot something. That's why I seemed distracted." I repeated one of our catchphrases. "Give me a hug, ladybug." Several of my resolutions reminded me of my happiness paradox. Happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. Did driving make me happier? Yes and no. Before October, I almost never thought about driving, and when I did, I felt a mild sense of uneasiness. Now I thought about driving frequently and with active dread. "I really want to get over this anxiety," I told Elizabeth on the phone one day. "I'm actually driving, which is progress, but I want to be free from the fear." "You'd have to drive every day for several years to take it for granted," Elizabeth said. "But you're driving. You just better keep it up, or you might stop altogether again." I look for chances to drive, then I dread it. But it is satisfying to know that I've conquered, somewhat, that fear. I never did manage to have a day of unbroken resolutions, but I did better. When Eliza started her guitar lessons, she asked me where to store her guitar. Instead of following my first impulse, to tell her to stow it in the back of a little used closet, I remembered the usefulness of convenience as a prop to self-control and told her she could keep it in the corner of her bedroom. The more convenient she found it to pick up her guitar, the more she'd play. A friend suggested that I get her a guitar stand, but that's exactly the kind of specialized, optional item that an underbuyer like me would never buy. Improvement was worthwhile, even if perfection proved elusive. As Benjamin Franklin observed of his own happiness project, "On the whole, though I never arrived at the perfection I had been so ambitious of obtaining, but fell far short of it, yet as I was by the endeavor a better and a happier man than I otherwise should have been if I had not attempted it." Over the last months, as my home began to reflect my inclinations and tastes more truly, I felt happier there. As the fifth splendid truth holds, I can build a happy life only on the foundation of my own nature. Just because something is fun for someone else doesn't make it fun for me, and vice versa, I repeated. I can choose what I do, but I can't choose what I like to do. Again and again, I realized that to be happy, I must be Gretchen. Empty shelves make some people happy. Collections make some people happy. Walking around the neighborhood makes some people happy. Walking along the Great Wall of China makes some people happy. What was true for me? A Zen koan holds, if you meet the Buddha on the road,